From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A vote on a radical change in the rules governing media ownership is just 2 weeks away, prompting the two Democratic FCC commissioners, Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein, to ask for a postponement. Chairman Powell, in defiance of a long-standing commission tradition, turned them down Friday. It was a last-ditch attempt to stall the commission from taking an action that could affect what the rest of us see and hear on TV and radio, OTM's Paul Ingalls reports.
The rules limiting multiple ownership have always been intended to promote a diversity of voices on the public airwaves and to prevent single owners from controlling too much news and entertainment programming. In recent years, some media companies have successfully appealed the restrictions, and the courts have demanded that the FCC prove the harm it says will come if restrictions were lifted.
The FCC, in some sense, is being forced by the courts to prove a negative.
Blair Levin is former chief of staff at the FCC and now a media analyst for Legg Mason Financial Services firm.
The problem for the FCC is if you look at the totality of all these decisions, it creates, shall we say, an obstacle course. And I think it actually makes it rather difficult to sustain the FCC's traditional views that we should apply something of a common sense rule here to simply prohibit transactions which we believe would result in less diversity in the media.
If the FCC is to make any ownership restrictions hold up in court, then it must be able to point to convincing data showing that the consolidation touched off by the easing of limits in 1996 has meant less diversity, less localism, and less competition. FCC Chairman Michael Powell, on record as a skeptic of the limits, had a special task force gather data on the effects of existing ownership limits on diversity and competition. In the meantime, opponents of further deregulation have been doing their own studies.
We've spent the last year doing an intense study of the impact of raising the ownership caps.
Jenny Toomey calls herself a rocker. She's an independent rock musician and the executive director of the Future of Music Coalition, which has joined other artist, labor, recording, and retail groups to oppose the easing of the ownership caps, as well as other broadcast industry trends they say hurt artists and limit choices for listeners. Their national random survey of 500 adults turned up some dissatisfaction with the state of deregulated radio.
Okay, half of the respondents, over 52%, say that radio would be more appealing to them if it offered more new music, less repetition, and more music of local bands and artists. Over 76% believe that DJs should be given more airtime for songs they think will be of interest to their audiences rather than to be required to play mostly songs of artists backed by recording companies.
Carolyn Gilbert oversees research for over 1,200 radio stations now owned by Clear Channel Communications, the company that took greatest advantage of the easing of ownership rules in 1996. She counters that her research shows that most listeners like the music they get from Clear Channel.
It's interesting also to hear people complain, well, consolidation is ruining radio. If you own too many, you can't possibly serve your community. And I'm watching just the opposite effect.
Gilbert maintains consolidation is bringing more format choices to communities compared to the days before the Telecom Act of 1996, when she worked for a company that could own no more than two stations in a single market.
There was no chance we were ever going to own a nostalgia station, a station targeted at older adults. Well, in Cincinnati, we own one that does really well because we have eight here, and we can serve the niche format. Because they all can't be number one. You can't make the money you need to support one radio station in a niche format, but you can if you've got a group. So it allows you to serve disparate groups in your community.
But according to Andrew Schwartzman, president of the Media Access Project, a citizens' rights policy group supporting more limits on ownership, Gilbert's Cincinnati example is a rarity. And he says Clear Channel's claim of greater format diversity leaves out an important statistic.
Data from the United Church of Christ Office of Communication, filed in March of this year, showed that the number of radio stations around the country has increased far more rapidly than the number of formats available. In other words, there are fewer formats per radio station. The data just suggests that Clear Channel is wrong.
Other broadcast ownership rules under review may not stand because the FCC feels it can no longer defend them in court cases brought by media corporations. Richard Wiley, who chaired the FCC in the 70s, now heads a law firm that represents many large media companies. and he believes the rule restricting a newspaper from owning a TV station in the same city should certainly be retired.
Because newspapers bring the journalistic tradition, they bring the whole concept of local news and public affairs to broadcasting, and yet I find some citizen groups oppose that change. And I think that's, again, a failure to really look at the industry and its problems and try to find pragmatic solutions that will meet the mutual goals that perhaps we all favor, that is diversity and competition and strong over-the-air broadcasting.
Observers may be split about the ultimate outcome, but most agree that the FCC and Chairman Powell will find it difficult to justify to Congress dropping all the ownership caps. Public interest groups in favor of keeping the limits have garnered the support of several senators from both sides of the aisle, several of whom have written a letter to the FCC strongly suggesting that more time and study be taken before new policies are set. Media analyst Blair Levin isn't surprised by the response of some legislators.
One thing that is very true about our members of Congress, the senators and congressmen all understand the importance of media for communicating and for engaging in political debate. And I think that there is a intuitive understanding that too much concentration could hurt them in their own efforts to communicate with the public.
2 weeks before the vote, this consensus of concern among lawmakers has become a crusade for many in Congress scrambling to slow the tide of deregulation. But leaked portions of the proposed changes circulated from the commission this week suggest that the lifting of some ownership restrictions is inevitable. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
With the deadline approaching for the final vote on media ownership, Washington is churning with heated hearings, unlikely coalitions, and whispers of vote trading. We asked Cable World's Alicia Mundy to give us the view from the Capitol.
Everybody is now entrenching, and this is becoming a battle for the hearts and minds and other parts of the anatomies of the media, the public, members of Congress, Wall Street analysts, and it's already gotten pretty vicious and bitter. The proposals were leaked out, I think, before they were actually printed out of the computers.
Alicia, when we last spoke about this, there seemed to be a 2-2 deadlock on the commission with the swing vote. Commissioner Kevin Martin, a Republican, poised possibly to surprise everybody to vote against Chairman Powell. But that seems to have changed. What's happened since we discussed this with you last?
He and Chairman Powell have come to an agreement. That's to say they cut a deal. Kevin Martin has decided that he will go ahead with a vote that will raise the national network ownership caps, which means that, let's say, CBS or ABC can buy more of their affiliated stations and reach more of the audience across the country than they can now. And in return for that, Michael Powell agreed that he would eliminate much of the ban against newspaper and broadcast station cross-ownership by agreeing that they would go down to the medium-sized markets. So it won't just be the 10 largest markets in the country where you can own both a newspaper and a broadcast station. It's probably going to go down to about the 50th market.
So, not to put too fine a point on it, it appears that Commissioner Powell has traded more deregulation for still more deregulation.
And won completely. He's got Kevin Martin's vote now. They have the three votes they need. Martin wanted the rule against cross-ownership eliminated entirely. So the fact that there is any remaining ban against newspaper cross-ownership in the smaller markets is a testament to Mr. Powell being able to horse trade something. But in return for that, the national network ownership cap will go up to 45%.
So what does it mean that the ownership cap for networks is going to 45% versus the existing 35%? Is it going to make any difference to anybody?
Oh, yes, because Fox right now and Viacom, that's CBS, are both interested in buying other stations out there. And right now, with this rule going, they could be allowed to reach almost half the country. And so, for instance, if your local station wants to, say, preempt the national network feed of Friends some night, God forbid, because there's a local debate or a local high school game, that won't be able to happen anymore because your local station will be owned by Mr. Big Network.
Politics, it is often said, makes strange bedfellows. And no stranger than some of the alliances that we've seen here. Tell me about Fritz Hollings and Ted Stevens, for example.
Fritz is a liberal Democrat. Ted Stevens is a conservative Republican. But they've both banded together to introduce a bill to keep the network cap at 35%. Now, they don't stand a chance of a snowball in Hades getting that bill passed, but it creates a lot of problems for the Republicans. There's one more strange alliance going on here, and that is the National Rifle Association has thrown its weight in against deregulating the media ownership rules. This is very weird because this week a group of Women for Peace are going to be picketing the FCC and pink slipping it, throwing pink slips of paper all over the FCC, complaining that they don't believe in deregulation. So you have the pink slip Women for Peace basically marching with the National Rifle Association here, and Ted Stevens marching with Senator Hollings. And, you know, I just don't know if I can cover it all.
There's a lot of entertaining politics going on. But it doesn't seem to me that this is an issue that has yet gotten traction with the American people. Is there any chance that in the final weeks of the battle that the public itself will somehow get energized about this, or will it be a genuinely obscure, inside-the-beltway fight to the very end?
I think it will be up to the two Democratic commissioners, Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein. They are certainly going to do their best, along with the public interest proponents, to make this a national issue, to force feed the national networks these stories. And if they can convince the networks that this is a national news story that they have to run, even though it may be flying in the face of the network's economic interests, you might get some reverberations among the public. But I think by and large it's going to stay a Beltway story, and in the end we'll be talking to each other on June 3rd about the vote that took place the day before.
All right, Alicia, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alicia Mundy is a senior editor for Cable World magazine and also a contributor to Editor and Publisher, Adweek, and almost every other magazine that I can think of.
Coming up, some of what's ailing America's newspapers and one reporter enraged over stolen stories.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Broadcast is not the only medium under the protective hand of government. A messy quarrel between two Seattle papers has focused attention on the strange world of joint operating agreements, or JOAs. These agreements make it possible for cities such as Cincinnati, Albuquerque, Birmingham, and Detroit to be two paper towns when they probably could support only one. Dan Gross recently looked at the issue for Slate.com. He called his story JOA-DOA. We'll find out why. Dan, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Brooke. It's nice to be here.
So tell me first, what specifically is a JOA supposed to allow papers to do?
It allows two newspapers to combine things like their printing presses, their ad sales, their distribution costs, have those run as a single entity while maintaining separate identities and separate newsrooms. The editorial staffs are completely separate and competing. The idea is that it's supposed to save fixed costs, thus allowing newspapers to survive.
And these joint operating agreements allow for certain practices like fixed ad rates that seem almost monopolistic in the way they work.
It's not so much monopolistic as antitrust behavior. This is a specific exemption from the antitrust laws. In 1970, Congress passed the Newspaper Preservation Act, which was intended to help forestall the decline or going out of business of many newspapers.
And currently there are about a dozen of these joint operating agreements. And as you noted in your column, they're mostly run by huge corporations who would seem not to need that kind of protection. Before we get to the argument at hand in Seattle, how do you think it's working overall?
Overall, if the intent of the Newspaper Preservation Act of 1970 was to preserve newspapers, it has explicitly failed. In 1970, there were 1,748 daily newspapers. Today, there are 1,468, and this is with a much larger population. People just don't read newspapers like they used to.
And in particular, they don't read afternoon newspapers at all.
Many of the original JOAs were entered between a better-off morning newspaper and a sort of struggling afternoon newspaper. So those were often the ones that were disappearing. Over the years, many of them have switched to morning editions. So you ended up with two morning papers in a single city that didn't necessarily have the advertising or readership to support them.
And largely because the readership is going somewhere else.
Yes, I don't think people are accessing information less or tuning things out. They're just getting it in different ways.
Okay, so now fill us in on what the heck is going on in Seattle.
In Seattle, you have the Seattle Times, which is owned by a family, and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which is owned by Hearst Corp., and they've been in a JOA for many years. The Times wants out, and it's been saying, we've been having these losses, we want the JOA to dissolve. The Times also owns the printing plants.
And so the Times wants a divorce, and
they
I assume the Post-Intelligencer doesn't.
They want a divorce, and they want to take the house. The Post-Intelligencer doesn't want out because it doesn't own the printing presses. If it were on its own again, it would either have to fix whatever old ones were there or buy new ones, and that would put it at a big competitive disadvantage.
And so then, if this marriage is dissolved, does that necessarily mean that the Post-Intelligencer goes down?
Not necessarily. The Hearst has massive resources. It could pave the way for an old-fashioned newspaper war.
Do you suggest that we should do away with JOAs altogether?
I question whether the daily newspaper business deserves some sort of exemption from antitrust rules that bind every other type of business and that bind other types of media companies. There's obviously something special about daily newspapers, and in many ways it's nostalgic. I think that in today's environment, when the barriers to starting a publication are comparatively small, I mean, you can start one on the internet for practically nothing, the notion that these very large corporations should get some kind of dispensation from the antitrust rules that everyone else has to play by increasingly doesn't seem to make sense.
So you think that these JOAs are pretty much a sepia-tinged innovation and their time has passed?
Well, there's something profoundly backward-looking about it. Even the name of the law, the Newspaper Preservation Act of 1970, it's as if an act of Congress could stand in the way of technological innovation and the sort of industrial changes that have been coursing through our entire economy in the 20th century. Any law, it strikes me, whether it's the Textile Industry Preservation Act, if there had been one in 1975, that would not have succeeded in keeping textile jobs here. There are forces that are mitigating against daily newspapers that are far stronger than an act of Congress.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Gross writes the Money Box column for Slate.com. Solvency is not the only problem plaguing newspapers. Accuracy is another. One out of every two stories in your daily newspaper, or for that matter in this show, will likely contain some type of mistake. It may be small, a grammatical error or a misspelled name, or something more serious, such as an incorrect or out-of-context quotation. One of the more remarkable aspects of the Jason Blair episode is why so few people misrepresented in his reports actually complained to the New York Times. In a story he first reported last summer on the media's John Solomon looks at the industry's mixed record in dealing with its own goofs.
The first time the average person realizes how many errors there are in the newspaper is usually when they read a story about a topic they know very well. That was no different for the editor of the nation's largest newspaper.
Virtually every story that was written about me when I took over as editor of USA Today had an error in it, and the track record hasn't changed much.
Editor-in-chief Karen Jorgensen.
I was surprised and disheartened by that, and it made me think if I see errors, readers see them as well.
She's not wrong about that. A poll by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press last summer found that 56% of the public think news organizations usually report inaccurately. That perception appears to be reality. Studies have continually shown that about half of all stories have an error in them. The newest analysis, an academic survey of news sources of the Raleigh, North Carolina News and Observer, found that 59% of the articles printed in early 1999 had at least one mistake. Obviously, the first draft of history is not going to be perfect. Between spelling, statistics, and precise quotations, hundreds of facts go into every story, usually written by human beings on deadline. While many errors are understandable, Tom Rosenstiel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, says they shouldn't all be acceptable.
The problem with accuracy is not that we get names misspelled, but it's what inaccuracies say to the public about the press. And they say that maybe we're slipshod in general, that we're not entirely trustworthy as a profession, not because there are inaccuracies per se, but because we just don't seem to worry about this stuff.
There are signs that the press is beginning to worry. After her own experience, Jorgensen created an error reduction program at USA Today, and the American Society of Newspaper Editors launched its own initiative to bring attention to the problem. Practically every other American manufacturing business long ago underwent comprehensive anti-defect quality control programs. The media, by and large, have not gone through the same kind of reengineering. But it appears change may be on the way in some places. Karen Jorgensen.
We had an editor one day look at some of this material and say, you know, some of these are the kinds of things that would involve a reporter taking the last 5 minutes of an interview and just saying, now let me go over these facts again. Let's go over the spelling of your name again. Let's go over your age again. Some fairly basic things like that.
The news organization which has addressed the error problem most extensively is the Chicago Tribune. It hired a retired editor to carefully review the paper for mistakes and then began tracking all errors by category. That immediately addressed some reoccurring trouble spots, according to Margaret Holt, the Tribune's customer service editor who manages the paper's quality control program. For example, in obituaries,
1 year we found that something like two-thirds of all the errors involve mistakes in either the time of the memorial service, the name of the deceased or the survivors, or the date of the memorial service.
Now, each section of the paper receives a quarterly error report with results and any problematic trends. The highly quantitative analysis is key, says Holt, because what gets measured ultimately gets managed.
Numbers make it easier for people to visualize what the issues are that you're talking about. That's much more effective than being able to say, golly shucks darn, we need to do a better job, and we've got to stop making these stupid mistakes.
Another Pew survey revealed that in the eyes of the public, inaccuracy is second only to bias as a reason to distrust the press. And bias actually may be more a problem of accuracy than ideology. In fact, when news sources were polled in the study of the News and Observer, those who complained about bias usually blamed process more than politics. University of Oregon journalism professor Scott Mayer authored the study, which was published in the newspaper Research Journal.
I don't think they saw it as a political bias or agenda setting, but rather that the reporter just didn't take the time to put that story in context and to be fair and to present all points of view.
If the media really want to reduce errors, argues Mayer, they have to be less passive about locating them. Of the 262 sources he surveyed who reported finding mistakes in News and Observer stories, only 1% said they actually contacted the paper afterwards to point them out. Some didn't know who to speak to, others did not believe that anyone would pay attention. But, says Mayer, that kind of feedback would be constructive for the papers themselves. It is long overdue that the media view corrections as less a threat to their credibility than an opportunity to improve their product. For On the Media, This is John Solomon.
Another pesky reporting problem that's received a lot of attention in recent days is plagiarism. Last week, in his weekly column on the NPR website, Ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin answered complaints about an interview segment on All Things Considered in April. He conceded that the segment had basically rehashed an LA Times article without advancing the story at all, and that the program should have credited the newspaper. It wasn't the first time NPR had been accused of lifting a story without proper attribution. This week, on Jim Romanesco's Media News website, one visitor expressed great satisfaction with NPR's apology. But, he remarked, other broadcast media outlets should also come clean. The writer, investigative reporter Jeff Stein, says he's been the victim of, quote, routine broadcast media thievery, most recently when 60 Minutes reported a story he had covered 2 years earlier. Jeff Stein, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Tell me first, please, about this article you wrote for Salon 2 years ago.
Well, it was a strange and bizarre story about a young woman who had written a freelance article about the owners of the Ringling Brothers Circus. And the owner of the circus was so upset by this article that he hired the former head of operations, i.e. Dirty Tricks, at the CIA, to turn her life upside down and make it miserable, ruin her career. And for 8 years, the CIA guy by the name of Claire George carried out a plan of dirty tricks against the woman named Jan Potker, treating her like she was Guatemala. They followed her around. They filed intelligence reports on her. And only through kind of a quirk did she find out about it 8 years later. And now she's suing them for $100 million.
Well, it's an amazing story. And it's thoroughly documented, largely with some of the court papers from her suit. But you invested, in order to get all of the proper documentation, a lot of time. How many man hours would you estimate that you put into the circus story?
I would say I spent 8 to 10 hours a day, 5 days a week or 6 days a week for about 6 weeks.
So your 9,000-word piece broke on Salon.com 2 years ago and got some follow-up, not a whole lot in the mainstream press.
There it sat dormant until I got a bunch of telephone calls a couple of weekends ago, people seeing the listing for 60 Minutes doing the story and saying, oh, are you going to be on 60 Minutes?
Okay, and now you knew to a moral certainty that you weren't going to be on 60 Minutes because they never called you for an interview on this story. What was the story on 60 Minutes?
The story on 60 Minutes included the basics of my story. Didn't do any original reporting, as far as I can tell. And in fact, the story omitted a few crucial details that signaled to me that they hadn't even gone down to the courthouse and done their own laborious research on the documents. They did get an extensive interview with Jan Potker, the freelance writer who had been victimized by the circus and its spies, and she hadn't talked to me much, but it was basically television kind of journalism where she got to say, I was an innocent victim.
Was there, in the piece reported by Morley Safer, any reference to your story on Salon.com?
None. Not a bit.
Okay, so you're sitting there and you're watching this. I imagine your jaw at that point is resting somewhere in the proximity of your chest. What were you thinking?
Well, at first I was appalled and felt really ripped off. But then this had happened to me before with 60 Minutes and other television magazine shows. I've been in journalism for 25 years, and I've seen my stories ripped off a number of times. And in particular, 60 Minutes. I can think of three offhand that they just took my story and filmed it.
Okay, now what you're describing, Jeff, it's not strictly speaking plagiarism. They didn't take your words or ideas and present them as their own. But it is something, and it's something that I think is quite common in broadcast journalism, using somebody else's reporting as a template to basically reproduce the reporting, only this time on tape. What's wrong with doing business that way?
Well, I'll give an example of what's wrong. Just a couple of days ago, the New York Times followed up on a story that my publication, a Congressional Quarterly, had broken. And in the third paragraph, they said, the story first reported by Congressional Quarterly. That's the way you should do it. And then they went out and did their own reporting. They confirmed the details in our story, and then they advanced it a little.
So it's something as simple as just a nod of the head towards the news organization that originally did the story. If you offer that nod of the head, are you then free to do exactly what is so often done, which is go to the very same sources named in, let's say, the print story, and to just reinvent the wheel?
Yeah, I think that they are, but they must give attribution. It's unethical to take someone else's story as if, and that's the strong implication here, as if you are breaking the story, when in fact someone else has broken that story. And I just think it's wrong. It's thievery.
And it's a pretty much standard operating procedure. What do you suppose it is about broadcast journalism that it believes it has license to operate this way?
You know, I am mystified by this. Maybe it's because it's just the way it's always been, and no one has really challenged them. And maybe there's a test case that should be done challenging these networks that would be very healthy for everyone, but I'm not very litigious. But I think I might sit down and talk to a media lawyer about it and see if there's a case to be made. Maybe that's a way to get attention to the issue. Sue them.
All right. Well, Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Investigative reporter Jeff Stein is also the editor of Congressional Quarterly's Homeland Security website. We called 60 Minutes about his allegations. Spokesperson Kevin Tedesco acknowledged that the story about the freelance writer and the Ringling Brothers CEO had been broken by Stein, but insisted that 60 Minutes was, quote, under no ethical obligation to attribute the story to him. And CBS News sent us this statement: print and broadcast journalists report every day on stories previously covered in some way, but they advance them and in doing so further inform the public. We advanced this story by landing the first extended interview the main character, Jan Podker, has ever given on the subject. Podker was not interviewed in Mr. Stein's original article.
Coming up, some cautionary words about election coverage and a look back at the first war reported on radio.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Nine Democrats seeking the presidency debated earlier this month, and neither the debate nor the coverage was especially inspiring. Perhaps it's too early with such a crowded field to tease out the differences among candidates. That at least is the opinion of Ed Helms, a senior correspondent for Comedy Central's Daily Show.
Sure, as a reporter, I could have taken the time to learn the candidates' names, study their positions, what they stand for, but at the end of the day, 8/9 of that research is going to be for jack all squat. I mean, Carol Moseley Braun? Life's too short.
Veteran journalist Robert Shogan has pondered the problems that plague election coverage since he began reporting on them in 1968, first for Newsweek and then for the LA Times. His book, Bad News, Where the Press Goes Wrong in the Making of the President, takes readers straight through Election 2000. He joins me now from his home in Maryland. Robert Shogan, welcome to On the Media.
Well, thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
Now, in the opening chapter of your book, Bad News, you write, "The new reality of the campaign trail boils down to this. The media all too often have been reduced to filling the role of enablers." Does that mean you're enabling the spinmeisters and the candidates to control the agenda?
If you think of the handlers and the candidates as people who are addicted to power, then the press assists in their fulfilling that addiction. Now, they don't do this deliberately, but they do it partly because it's difficult not to, because the candidates and the handlers really do set the agenda.
It hasn't always been the case, then, that the media were enablers. When did that start?
I think it started back in 68 as a result of Vietnam and the social and political upheaval of that year. You had a big change in parties, first in the Democratic Party that was dramatized by the chaos at the Chicago Convention, the blood in the street, that then spread to the Republican Party. What it was is the end of the old structure, an ordered system of politics in which you had the bosses, so-called, who sat around in smoke-filled rooms and picked candidates. Well, there was a little bit of exaggeration to that, but not all that much. So you had the death of the way both parties controlled the political system.
So you saw the decline of the party bosses after a disastrous war and violence in the streets during the conventions, and then what happened?
Well, it was sort of a free-for-all. All of a sudden, the power seemed to be held in the hands of the public. Well, how do you reach the public? You do that through the media. So it wasn't the media who had the power. It was, in a sense, the voters, but the media became important because by manipulating and influencing them, you could get at the voters and turn them into followers.
The power went out to a much more drawn-out state-by-state primary system, and it was during that drawn-out period where the media were able to interpret the candidate for the public.
I mean, that's the way the media would like to see it, or that's the way I suppose it would be. But in fact, the media is not all wise or all knowing. What the candidates do and their handlers is to influence the media so that they convey the impression that they want. The media really doesn't have its own agenda. I know there are people who think that the press is biased one way or another. But the truth is that the agenda for most reporters out there is they want to make a living. And they want to get stories in the paper.
What is the worst coverage of a political campaign that you've seen?
I don't know that it's the worst, but it's certainly the most recent. I think the press coverage of the presidential debates in the 2000 campaign was terribly one-sided. And the obsession with Gore's manner, his sighing and his smirking, or whatever it was he did, that became a major force in the debate. It's wrong for two reasons. First of all, I mean, Bush also told untruths and made mistakes and looked foolish at times, and that was sort of ignored. I mean, the other thing is that there were really substantive issues that had to be dealt with and could have been addressed, and there were real differences.
And you said the press ignored them.
You look at the stories and look at the tremendous emphasis on minutiae and trivia as if it was, I call it chapter in Ben's ballots on Broadway, because the press behaved as if they were theater critics. Sometimes it seemed they were covering a farce.
What do you anticipate will happen this time around?
The real challenge in the campaign will be to cover George Bush as a candidate and not as the reigning chief executive. He will be photographed issuing grants or making announcements and doing other favorable things. Then the press will be covering the Democrat candidate who will be out there running for office and scrambling for votes. And he will look like sort of a Willie Loman guy with a shoe shine and a smile. I remember something Dick Cheney told me back in 76 when he was running, in effect, Gerald Ford's campaign. Ford was not the most highly thought of president. But what Cheney said is, look, he is the president. The other people are all pretenders. So the press has got a hard job, and they have to just try and write about the things that the president says as if they were writing about that of a candidate for political office. They have to wake up early in the morning, go to bed late at night, and type very fast and make a lot of phone calls.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert Shogan is author of Bad News, Where the Press Goes Wrong in the Making of the President.
And now for a few of your letters. Steve Kasner wrote in to say that for the past several weeks, he's been passing up The Simpsons to hear our show, which we sincerely regard as high praise indeed. In particular, he singled out our report called Trading Liberties, calling it, quote, one of the best single reports I've encountered regarding the U.S. government's attacks on civil liberties. Actually, we had a lot of letters like that, although they didn't mention The Simpsons.
Lee Hydehues of San Francisco wrote in to say that in my discussion of a new Hitler miniseries, my reference to communists burning the Reichstag was only partially correct. He writes, a patsy was found, one Marinus Vandeluba, a, quote, half-witted Dutch communist with a penchant for arson. Mr. Hydehues refers to the historian William Shirer's account, which suggests that Vandeluba wasn't capable of that infamous conflagration, that it was organized by, quote, the newly selected Nazi government troops. However, later research by contemporary historians still leaves the question of who set that fire very much in doubt. And by the way, in the skit about Hitler on The Larry King Show, it was Mike O'Mara of the Don and Mike radio show who played Larry King, not Mike O'Malley, as I said last week. John Stewart, of course, played Hitler.
Keep your letters and corrections coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. But don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Gulf War II was the first war that viewers had the ability to watch in real time. But it wasn't the first in which reporters offered play-by-play narration from the battlefield. Years from now, we'll recall images of this war through the green stain of night vision goggles, just as people who came of age in the 1940s remember World War II as a series of vignettes shrouded in a veil of radio static, delivered by Edward R. Murrow. Now, highlights from Murrow's reporting and that of his so-called Murrow's Boys have been compiled on a CD that accompanies a new book called World War II on the Air. Mark Bernstein is one of the book's two authors, and he joins me now. Mark, welcome to the show.
Well, pleased to be here.
As we've recently been reminded, every war is different from the previous because of changes in technology. But it's also true, at least for the last century, that the coverage of every war is different for the same reason. How did radio change the face of war journalism?
Well, I think it brought to war journalism and to journalism generally an immediacy that had not previously been available. In August of 1940, Edward Murrow was standing in Trafalgar Square in London, which was under blackout. It was being bombed. And he was standing at the entrance of a bomb shelter. And Londoners were going past him into the shelter. And he took his microphone and put it down at street level and recorded the sound of British people in their very unhurried way taking shelter from bombs. And then this went, you know, to Kansas and Nebraska and Florida and wherever. And you would hear 4,000 miles away the sounds of actual human beings taking shelter from war.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid siren. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance. There's another searchlight. You see them reach straight up into the sky, and occasionally they catch a cloud and seem to splash on the bottom of it. One of the strangest sounds one can hear in London these days, or rather these dark nights, just the sound of footsteps walking along the street, like ghosts shod with steel shoes.
He said it was not the purpose of radio to take the story to the listener, but to bring the listener to the story. And I think the clip you just heard, you get pulled to that event, and you to some extent experienced for yourself.
Murrow was famous for painting dramatic word pictures. He was also famously a non-journalist, at least before he got his job with CBS. He had no print experience to draw on. What effect did his fresh eyes, say, have on his coverage and on other journalists who followed him?
He had a sense that what happens on the radio has to happen differently, that very much you have to write for the ear. And he felt it was an advantage that he had no journalism background to speak of, because the people he hired who had journalism background, like Eric Severide and Charles Collingwood and Howard K. Smith and others, in a sense had to be retrained to write for the new medium.
Let me ask you about the relationship between these reporters and the U.S. military. That relationship is notably testy today and has been for a good many years. How did they get along back in 1944?
Well, it would get down to cases. Eric Severide had a kind of somewhere between frustration and contempt for the military mind, or at least the minds of officers who he felt were always, you know, misrepresenting everything to him and thwarting him. Murrow, who was enormously charming, got along well with just about everybody. He and Collingwood, incidentally, both wore British, not American, uniforms for much of the war, which they did to one-up the Americans. It was a way of saying, well, we've been here since 1939, you know, where you been? The British, I think, realized in time that Murrow's telling of the story of London during the Blitz and the story of England standing up to Hitler had enormous propaganda value in the United States, and they progressively censored him less. And in September of 1940, they allowed him to do live coverage from rooftops of London of the bombing of London. The approval for that came actually directly from Winston Churchill, who many, many years before had been a war correspondent in the Boer War and had a sense of what was a really good story and how it would play.
Now you'll hear two bursts a little nearer in a moment. There they are. That hard, stony sound.
Edward R. Murrow was one of the two most famous American reporters in Europe during the war. The other was Ernie Pyle, who spent the entire war with GIs, slogging through with the riflemen to report on their victories and their defeats and their personal dramas. Edward R. Murrow didn't do a lot of that, but he did do some of it. There was one extraordinary period when he went on bombing missions with the American Army Air Corps.
His ostensible reason for doing so was that he wanted to be able to report on the war better by actually experiencing such a thing. I think it's likelier the case that Murrow did not feel that he was sufficiently at risk. He is this much admired, much honored broadcaster, relatively safe in London, while people elsewhere are fighting and dying in significant numbers on behalf of a cause and a war that Murrow himself very much believed in. And he basically badgered CBS and badgered the military in England to let him go on bombing runs over Germany. Eventually, he got permission to go. This would be December 1943. And he went on one run. 500 planes went out, 50 were shot down. It was an extremely hazardous thing to do. He then got a very short note from Bill Paley, three sentences. The first said, I understand why you want to do this, and I guess you feel good now that you've done it, but please, 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 don't ever do it again. He did it 22 more times.
Waiting to jump. There goes, you hear him shout? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15... Every man clear. They're dropping just beside a little windmill near a church, hanging there very gracefully. Seem to be completely relaxed, as I said a moment ago, like nothing so much as khaki dolls hanging beneath a green lampshade.
So there were embeds six decades ago.
Oh, sure. Eric Severide was on the first line of landing craft coming into the south of France in July 1944. Eric Severide, alone among all the correspondents, was always telling everyone he was terrified. Everyone else was being sort of macho about it. Richard C. Hazlett hung a tape recorder out a window in Aachen, Germany, to record the sounds of a firefight in which he was sort of in the midst. And Charles Collingwood was with the assault at Normandy on June 6th.
These boys are apparently having a pretty tough time in here on the beaches. It's not very pleasant. It's exposed, and it must have been a rugged fight to get it. Further up the beach, there's a fire, which has apparently just been started by enemy shelling. It's maybe a quarter of a mile...
Charles Collingwood on D-Day, June 6, 1944. At the beginning of the war, the world got used to hearing Murrow live and in real time describe the events of the war that was surrounding him. At the end of the war, the world had the opportunity to hear Murrow deliver a report in which his words were 3 days considered, 3 days measured.
Permit me to tell you what you would have seen and heard had you been with me on Thursday. It will not be pleasant listening. If you're at lunch, or if you have no appetite to hear what Germans have done, now is a good time to switch off the radio. for I propose to tell you of Buchenwald. It is on a small hill about 4 miles outside Weimar, and it was one of the largest concentration camps in Germany, and it was built to last. I asked to see one of the barracks. I was told that this building had once stabled 80 horses. There were 1,200 men in it, five to a bunk. As I walked down to the end of the barracks, there was applause from the men too weak to get out of bed. It sounded like the hand clapping of babies. As we walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead. Two others, they must have been over 60, were crawling towards the latrine. I saw it, but will not describe it.
Do you hear a qualitative difference between Murrow live and Murrow having had a chance to digest and think through the report he was about to give?
I think, well, you know, one thing that's happening is that for half a dozen years, Edward Murrow has been talking about Nazism as the face of evil. And at Buchenwald in April 1945, he, for the first time, encounters that living, dying face. And it is, and I think he commented on this at the time, basically more than he could cope with. He talked later about, you know, if he was called upon to describe half a dozen pairs of children's shoes, he could do that. But confronted with a pile of thousands of children's shoes, he couldn't think of anything to say.
Mark Bernstein is co-author of the book with accompanying CD, World War II on the Air. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Blake Carlton and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.